Well, thank you again, Nikki. It's actually rare. Most of the time we end up running around with fairly hectic schedules that we get to pay tribute to each other, and I can't think of a better tribute that I've received probably ever. And it is really an honor to be here, and I can't think of a better place to be doing this than APHA. I will say it took me quite a while to get from the lobby to the down here, because of course I ran into people. Some of the conversation started with, you know, we ran into each other last year and we started to conspire about something and we didn't connect, but we should do it now, that kind of thing. So it is really an incredible honor. Maybe this works.
You got the mouse. The mouse is good.
Yeah. Oh, wait a minute, I'm clicking the wrong side. There we go. So I won't read you the quote from Donna Bedian. Let me say that in addition to many of the attributes that Nikki presented, I think you'd have to pay tribute and honor to Avitas Donna Bedian for being relentlessly in pursuit of a vision, something that I would say also defines my good friends and colleagues, both Gordy and Nikki. Gordy describes himself highly inappropriately, I might note, as a modest guy. But, you know, back at Cook County, very inspired by why can't we do better by the patients we're trying to serve. Our aspirations are way, way up here, and what's actually happening every day in the clinic and the hospital is not way, way up here. How do we close that gap? Really inspired me going way, way back. And I'm sorry to say that right at the moment, if you are one of those ARC-funded projects, you've actually survived some pretty ruthless competition. So if there's one thing that I think is pretty interesting in this idea is the notion of precise application of what we know to the care of individual patients. And that kind of precision or application at all has not been considered terribly glamorous or important work. In fact, the other quote that often comes to mind is John Gardner, who happened to be secretary of what was then HEW when Medicare and Medicaid were signed into law. And he's got this fantastic quote where he says, you know, if we revere mediocre philosophers just because it's philosophy and scorn plumbers simply because it's plumbing, any society that does that will soon find that neither its theories nor its pipes hold water. And a big part of the problem in quality is literally the application of that science. So here we are, we lead the world in many ways in biomedical science, and yet precise application, I'll just say not so much every day. And Gordy talked about prior winners. The one, I mean, these are all incredibly impressive people coming from very, very different vantage points, and many of whom have taken very interesting turns in their careers. Lisa Iazzoni in particular, beginning to really take a deep dive into how unprepared the healthcare system is to meet the needs of people with disabilities. Many of us recognize this now, talking to friends or colleagues whose parents are in a different place now than when we were younger. And, you know, just navigating your average office practice with someone in a wheelchair is suddenly a real eye-opening experience, dealing with the needs of people who are deaf, and the list goes on and on. We have a lot to learn in terms of being responsive to patients' needs. The other person I would just call out here is Barbara Starfield, who passed away this past June, and I think has been a beacon to many of us who come out of a primary care world. I went to a memorial service for her at Hopkins, and it was impossible to miss that of the several hundred people gathered there, all of them touched hundreds more, all of whom had been touched by Barbara, and Vicente Navarro was assuring me that there were many celebrations being held around the world, and I have full confidence that that is the case. And I do have to say that we're very proud to have MyFam working with us now in the new Innovation Center at CMS. So two places where I just wanted to say where I felt incredibly immersed in Donna Bedian's work. I never did actually have the privilege of meeting with him. In the late 80s, the Joint Commission came around and said they wanted hospital-based clinics to do something about quality. So we had sort of a matrix management arrangement, which was medicine, nursing, and administration from the hospital. And I said, if we're going to spend 10 minutes, we should do something worthwhile. And we started off with fantastic aspirations of, you know, creating our own electronic health record. I'm quite sure we would have done it, by the way. The hospital was having no part of that. And some other ideas. What we ended up with was pre-printed stickies, you know, those little pads, right on the front of the chart that told residents what to do for prevention. Worked like a charm. So computerized decision support is not the only way to get there. We had to have enhanced same-day access. We didn't call it then. But there, about a third of our patients were from outlying rural areas. We could make them appointments, but they came when they got a ride into town. That was just real life. And then I turned to the nurses and said, gee, I think that you need to evaluate diabetic teaching. Well, it's just like talking to your favorite teachers about performance measures in education. A really great idea for healthcare, not for us. And they pushed back, but ultimately they did it. And they said, you know, we know the patients love this. They're nodding, they're enthusiastic. And I said, well, fine, then I'm just suggesting that we try calling them back a couple of days later to see if they remember what you told them. And they did call them back. And so we didn't have like an independent evaluator or anything like that. And it turned out they didn't remember anything. And they completely revamped it. And they kept saying, I can't understand this. They're always smiling and nodding away. And I said, well, you were their last stop in a many-hour journey. You know, anyone would have been smiling. They can see light at the end of the tunnel. They get through this. And you know what's bizarre about this is today I'm hearing the same story from people in hospitals who, when they finally grasp that readmissions, avoidable readmissions, matter a lot, and they're going to matter in terms of what the hospital gets paid, have started to learn the same thing. What they haven't learned how to say, tell me what you heard. I didn't learn that in med school. I learned it from a pharmacist. And I didn't have a name for it. Safety people would call that readback. But I knew it was profoundly important in that moment. And then John and I worked on a paper for Science. For those of you who do get into the business of writing at all, you know when you've got to write 2,000 words and they mean not a word more, and you start with about six, and then multiple surgical applications and all that, and by the time it's done, you just can't believe that this bears any relationship to where you started. But at that point, I felt like I knew more about Don Abedian's work than possibly his close family. But at the end of the day, where we are right now is trying to figure out how do we get into this business of applying what we know to the unique circumstances of taking care of individuals in healthcare? And ultimately, we know that we can't possibly do that without partners in public health. If you look at how we're doing in chronic illness care, we have a long way to go. So here's our healthcare system for you in quality. On the one hand, door to balloon time, right? A good payment, lots of good reasons, very strong science. Almost hit that out of the park. Over 90% of the time, people get there in a timely fashion. Through the important discoveries such as, in many institutions, the rate-limiting step. Does anyone know this? Knowing which cardiologist was on call induces a lot of delay if you don't know who to call. The breakthrough was realizing you don't need to know which cardiologist is on call. You need a beeper number tied to whoever is on call within 10 minutes. That's really all you need to do. And that's a tribute to a colleague at Yale, Harlan Krumholtz, the American Heart Association, and many others making a really big deal out of this and challenging what are the boundaries of research and inquiry to embrace and encompass application of knowledge. But if you look at what we're measuring just for health plans, this is not super precise in terms of chronic illness management. We're not doing so great. The top 10% of plans, some of whom are working very hard on this, get it right about 70% of the time. So that's a pretty high failure rate. So this is a pretty core business for ARC and has been since the agency was created. Thank you again, Nikki. I understand that all too well. Since 2001, we've had the privilege of becoming the world's leading funder of patient safety, and there is a lot to learn. We support work on the use of health IT, or what Gordy would call the smart use of health IT, I think, to improve safety and quality. That is to say, to get to the place when it actually adds value to people's workdays, which would be a whole lot, about giving back data instead of just taking it in and teaching people new routines. And we make a whole lot of data available, and we do a lot of work in comparative effectiveness research. Oh, and just in case none of this sounded controversial, we also provide scientific support to the Preventive Services Task Force. So there you go. We can make someone mad every day if we want to. And we have this incredible opportunity starting in 2003 to publish and submit to the Congress an annual report on quality and one on disparities. So the good news is that every year since 2003, we have seen statistically significant improvements in quality across all settings in all populations. We've even seen some reductions in disparities, not nearly enough. Disparities associated with race, ethnicity, income, education remain stunningly pervasive, but we know they're not immutable. It's not the 11th commandment that this is how it is and it has to stay that way, because we're tracking the same measures over time. If you're into data, you will love these reports. The slightly less good news is the pace of that improvement is pretty modest. So every time I hear a health system or company making these astonishing claims about, you know, adding value, we dropped costs dramatically and improved quality, you know, like out of this world, I keep thinking, I keep hearing people make this claim and I'm not seeing it in the statistics. So it is a real benchmark for how are we doing. Now, the good news in the past couple of years is we've had a lot of resources, because we're not doing so well in quality, not through any lack of will, right? Many, many clinicians, many not as articulate, but many would match Gordy Schiff inch by inch for aspiration in terms of what they want to do for their patients every day. And I think they find it increasingly frustrating that what they see in real life just isn't working. Or it seems to work well right here where I'm in charge and can make changes, but when I refer my patient to someone else, it's not working so well, and so forth. And, you know, even people like friends who are anesthesiologists will tell me they get called to consult on a patient and they're sort of appalled when they're flipping through the chart and then reminding themselves to focus, but at the same time thinking, what's wrong with this picture? Part of it is that we have been trained to see patients one at a time, do the very best you can, and move on, right? And we've been trained to celebrate the uniqueness of each individual so much that we forgot sort of the common evidence base that can also be very helpful. And we don't look back, ever. The only two times in my entire career we've ever looked back, one was in the emergency room, the radiologists come in and tell you what you messed up. Reading their films, by the way, while they're home in bed. That's a whole other story. But at least it's very potent on your mind, and you get to know if you missed something big, what was wrong here, and so forth. It's very helpful. It's timely. You know, this person was in here yesterday or a day before, and so forth. And the other place was a physician-led home care team when I was in Richmond. And this came about by accident. The guy leading it and I were creating a database to do a study of their patient population. And those of you who have ever reviewed patient charts, it was easier pre-HIPAA, I will say that, know that one of the big challenges is you always discover unexpected things when you're reviewing charts. Wow. Because of all those oops moments, this team created a new policy where they sat down together as a group, about six or seven of them, every single week and marched through every chart. Because they're a pretty vulnerable, high-risk group of people, and it made a big difference. That's it. That's my list. I'd like to think I'm so young that there'd be more coming, naturally, but that isn't quite the case. So the Recovery Act gave us enormous resources for comparative effectiveness, and a quarter of that $1.1 billion went to data infrastructure, in the name of registries, distributed networks, and so forth. And of course, the Affordable Care Act has many, many quality provisions, a very much untold story. Now, these provisions aren't like a novel or a movie, but in other words, they don't all add up logically. But I think that's not a bad reflection of where we are right now. And ultimately, there are some big questions about how do we get from point A to point B. if Gordy has an incredible success at Cook County or at Beth Israel, I'm sorry, it's Brigham, isn't it? Sorry. I know that this happens to be very important in the Harvard landscape. What you really want to know is, will it work somewhere else? Can we generalize or replicate that? How do we get the science right? You know, people who are whose jobs are on the front lines, when they hear the word theory, get really nervous until you tell them, without some kind of framework, you don't know if you can repeat this. That's really all it's about. It isn't, the point isn't to use it as a weapon. The point is to try to understand so that we understand if it can work elsewhere. Researchers are really, really good at sort of walling themselves off from sort of the messy world of practice when they want to. And in real life, you want to know, does it work when it's that messy? Does it work when people are stressed, when there's unanticipated emergencies, and so forth? And if it does work, can it be scaled up? So I'll tell you about a success. And it seems to me that the way we've got to think about getting there is literally building a new cultural and scientific model. One that is based on having information that's just in time, not storing it all up here, but really knowing where to get it when you need it in a very timely fashion. Incentives, which I actually think the more lasting type are professional incentives. You know, I have a dentist who I am terrified will retire soon, and I have some pretty advanced problems, so this makes me nervous. But what's really such a joy to see him about is he gets such a charge out of getting it right, you know? So it's wildly inconvenient for me to continue to get care there, and I wouldn't even think of seeing someone else because he gets such joy in getting it right. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think that does more for professionals than anything. But you got to have a structure in order to get that information rapidly and so forth. So the Affordable Care Act has lots and lots of opportunities to get the information piece right. There's a national strategy for quality improvement. We've continued all this work in effective healthcare, comparative effectiveness. Our work in the reports keeps going. And we also created a site called the Healthcare Innovations Exchange. Healthcare here being an incredibly broad umbrella, because some of the most active people are people who are worried about access for the most vulnerable patient populations. Long before the Affordable Care Act became law, or to say much less about it becoming unpopular, you know, these folks would say, look, I know we're going to have health reform. I have full faith in the president, but no one is coming after the people we're worried about. And they've created their own community. The reason we created this site was to actually capture some of the energy, enthusiasm, and learning from people on the front lines, on the ground, who don't live in a world where they get promoted or incentivized to make publications and so forth. They're passionate about solving problems. So I would commend that one for your attention. A lot of the researchers who we fund want to know, so, has the Affordable Care Act changed your priorities? And my answer to that is, no, not at all, and fundamentally. And the reason I say that is we've been worried and working on these issues for a long time, and because we've had the privilege of funding groundbreaking thinkers like Gordy and Appliers, we've made some progress. What we haven't had is receptor sites. So the fundamentally comes because the Affordable Care Act includes a lot of levers to get people interested. Sorry, keep doing this. All right. I've done this in a while. And the CMS now has a new Center for Innovations, and we're working very, very closely with them, which is pretty interesting. It's a new idea to have an insurance company funding this kind of work. People are obviously very, very excited about that. And I'll tell you a little bit about the big patient safety initiative in a moment. But this infrastructure piece, I think, is going to be really important. And I think it's fair to say we are so not there right now. We're getting the lingo down. We've got electronic health records. We have a lot of people with serious headaches from these electronic health records. We haven't gotten to the place where the needs of the healthcare system and clinicians and patients are actually driving how we build these systems. But we're getting there. If anything, I may have more faith personally in e-prescribing and personal health records. Because at the end of the day, this has to be this has to be a production or a script where patients and their loved ones are sort of co-producers of this final act. We're not going to get there without it. But there's a lot of very exciting work in progress. And one important success that we have had, one of the few home runs I can point to in healthcare, there are, I think, a few more in public health, is in reducing one type of important serious healthcare-associated infection, and that is the central line infections, better told by Atul Gawande in The New Yorker, to be honest, which changed my social life. Now when people ask me what I do when I'm out with my husband, we're not out with my people, right, but his people, and I say, you know, he always shoots me this look that more or less says, don't get into the details. Keep it light. So now I can just say, do you read The New Yorker? And, you know, everyone's read about the checklist. Four very common categories of infections that not only create a serious threat to people's health, sometimes they actually kill them or leave them seriously impaired. Nothing new about these infections. What was new was that this team at Hopkins decided to try to take on the central line infections. And what's also interesting about the application gap here is we actually supported a systematic review of all the studies out there. It was published 4 years ago. Just missed Peter Pronovost's first study of this central line challenge by about a week. And what was amazing was it's a thin literature and it's mostly single institution studies. Very, very small cast of characters. And I remember vividly as a resident being told that this was grunt work. Probably not bad that somebody was doing it, but nobody important would do it. That is, I think, the gap that we have to change. So this was a smashing success in Michigan. One of the keys, and if you meet anyone from Michigan who was part of it, the checklist is actually as many different checklists as there are hospitals. Now, each one is about 99% the same, but every hospital feels like they've got their own little winning formula. That is fantastic. They collected a little bit of data, and they got quarterly feedback so that people could see, connect the dots between this stuff we're doing. This tends to be a little difficult with the doctors. They don't like these kind of like team meetings. And the goal we're trying to achieve, and suddenly a problem that seemed like inevitable background challenge started to drop precipitously. And, you know, a critical care leader said to me, this changes our ideas about what's possible. So we are now spreading this across the country. Unfortunately, right at this moment, progress is modest. It is still voluntary. There's not enough of a signal. I mean, it's a little bit, I think, perceived as still a bit on the altruistic side. Future payment changes will change that for Medicare. But you still get paid to do a lot of stuff that people don't need for very expensive procedures, more than you do to do it right. But ultimately, what's very, very helpful, and I'm thrilled to see Art Levin here, is having informed consumers speak up, which really, in many, many initiatives we've sponsored, has been a real game changer. Because when consumers start saying things like, can you tell me this again? You think it's okay if one person in five in an ICU actually has such a serious infection that a quarter of them die? Huh? What's wrong with this picture? Why isn't this a national emergency? It really does, it changes the responses, particularly of doctors around the table who say, this is so important. In fact, it's so important, we really have to get it right, which means we have to go at a glacial pace, to, yes, we can. We can actually do this. We call on Art regularly. And in fact, there is a training video posted on HHS's website for those of you who are looking for tools or whatever to use at home. What's really nice about this is it makes it very, very personal. And it's a way to, it offers a tool to help teach teams. Because at the end of the day, this is a team sport. You know, the world I was trained in was that high quality of care, all paths cross the doctor's brain directly. And it was a matter of being a superstar athlete. It's not. It's about being part of a superstar team. A very, very different set of skills. So as I said, we are now taking this approach and applying it to other types of infections, also adverse events in labor and delivery, and so forth. And, you know, we're going to discover new tensions. We already are. Should we apply pretty much the same approach, which some might find cookbook, some, quite honestly, are totally thrilled to be given a recipe for success, if I could use that language. Others say you're stifling innovation. I think if we can all agree on the goal and we're measuring to make sure we're getting there, you cannot hang the checklist or a checklist or anything else on the wall and presume that people will feel so inspired that all the pieces will fall into place. You actually have to track how you're doing. If you achieve the goal, I don't personally care how you got there, if you didn't hurt anybody. But so we'll see how that shakes out. But because the science of improvement is in such a state of infancy, but we felt like we had such a smashing success here that we really needed to make sure that as many people as possible could do that. So 3 years ago, Medicare basically says to hospitals, we're not going to pay extra for care that is associated with avoidable harms. Well, never events. It inspired some debate in the academic community. What does avoidable mean? Does it have to be 100% avoidable? What if it's 90% avoidable? Putting that aside, we have way too many of them where we know what the right thing to do is and it didn't happen. So Don Berwick, whose leadership at CMS has been really amazing, the political battles obviously get covered quite a bit. But what's more remarkable to me is when I interact with some of his senior folks who have a newfound sense of purpose, energy. One guy over there who's very knowledgeable and very, very helpful, but kind of a curmudgeon, almost like has a new personality. And this happens all the time. So how does Don do that? Well, this guy tells me the curmudgeon, you know? We went in to talk to Don about a really technical aspect of some final rule for people in dialysis facilities. Don has a dialysis patient in his office, and he starts talking to her about what quality means to her. You know, everybody leaves this meeting walking 3 feet above the ground. That's what I mean by inspiring. And I don't think people get to see enough of that. So this particular partnership takes that list, expands it a little bit of these healthcare-associated conditions, harms that are avoidable, as well as a strong focus on avoidable readmissions. Now, we still don't have the best metric in the world for knowing which ones are avoidable. Let me tell you what avoidable looks like. My stepmother calls me last year during the National Quality Forum meeting, crying so hard I can't understand her. If you knew her, not her at all. She's crying because of a miscommunication about Coumadin. My father has just been readmitted to the hospital. Here's how this went. The nurse called the house and said to my stepmother, give him two. It was self-evident to her that she meant milligrams, equally self-evident to my stepmother that she meant pills, right? We do that all the time. Tell me what you heard. Right? Starbucks does a better job of telling you what you heard, right, than we do in healthcare, and we can do a whole lot better. This is just the National Strategy for Quality in Healthcare. It's a little more detailed than that, but the idea is that you should get great care wherever you land. Not great care if you're really smart and know how to surf the web and, you know, have connections in healthcare and so on and so forth, but great care wherever you land. So when I land in a very tiny hospital in Western Mass because I have the poor judgment to get sick on vacation, I get great care there too. Actually, I did, although at that moment it brought home to me the value of thinking about great care everywhere. Obviously, the healthcare system can't own what goes on out in the community. It would probably be a really good thing that we recognize that right at the outset. At the same time, if the healthcare system and the considerable resources allocated to it isn't a positive force for addressing the upstream and root causes of multiple chronic illnesses and other threats to people's health, then we are never going to we can't solve this problem even by making quality of care perfect. We're going to be bailing out against a rising tide. So, and in particular for chronic illnesses, you could look at our healthcare system and think we designed a system for 50 years ago. And unfortunately, it's not 50 years ago, because we're not really equipped to deal with chronic illnesses. And if there's one thing I've learned dealing with my dad, it's exactly that. It's not all about health care. I know that part. It's very much about the how do you live with this? How do you go about real life with this? It's about social service needs. It's about a whole lot of things. It's about persuading someone who's been independent and highly functional that that's not where they are anymore. And if we don't think about costs, now, of course, clinicians and patients every single day think about costs a lot. They have to. You couldn't begin to practice without it. I'm not talking about rationing. I'm talking about all of the money we waste in how care is organized right now. And I think we have so much waste to get out of the system. And ultimately, I want to go back to this point that Julian Tudor Hart, who I know is also a hero of Gordy's, inspired us with this notion of patients as co-producers of health. A few years ago, this might be an inside baseball story, but a famous Republican on our advisory council named Newt Gingrich came up with an idea that ARC should be more or less the Google Health for personal records. Now, he didn't use that wording. He said we should be the repository. At the moment, I was finding him so irritating, I literally physically did not hear it. He was sitting 3 feet away. I noticed it in the summary later and called to my colleagues and said, what do you think? And after actually talking to a lot of patients and consumers, we thought, no, people, this is not what they want. They're not even asking basic fundamental questions, so we started working with the Ad Council on and building tools to encourage people to ask questions. My father died about a year ago, and never, ever did I get him to ask questions. Medication list, yes. Questions, no. Some of this is a generational thing, but it requires a lot of active encouragement and so forth. And quite recently, one of our colleagues went out and found real patients who talked about their experience asking questions, how important it was for them to have some control, to feel empowered by having an important role in their own health and healthcare. I'm just showing you a picture from one. They're all over our website. And there's even videos of real live doctors who say, when I'm a patient, I bring my list of questions. You should do that too. And they talk about how it makes their jobs much easier. So it's a lot more about modeling the behavior. This is the picture of one of the clinicians. So at the end of the day, we've got to raise our sights, not just our aspirations, which, if we were honest, have always been aspirations more along the line of, I want to wake up thinner as a way to solve the obesity problem, right? But if we are serious about the commitment to doing the very, very best we can in healthcare, then we can really get to a place where application is not sort of scorned as second-tier minor league work, but actually is celebrated and helps us to build and inform the next iteration of the research that we need in science that actually matters to people's health and health care. So thank you again for this incredible award. And
so let's do, we've allowed ourselves a